I expect that most of you know the name Dylan Thomas, reporter, writer, poet in the first half of the 20th century. If you don't know the name, you at least know the last two lines of his most famous poem, which goes, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light." But there's a less famous poem that ends with, if you will, today's theme. It's from this side of the truth. And the last three lines are, "And all your deeds and words, each truth, each lie, die in unjudging love." I'm going to end with another poem on the same theme from my favorite poet, Gerhard Frost. And the theme is that God is not fair, that God has the game rigged. God is love, and love is not fair. Anyone who's ever been in love knows that love is not fair. It's not fair or rational or logical or even predictable. Love just is, and it is powerful. And the force of love is also eternal. But before I go any further, I want to spend a little time on the context of the gospel lesson. It has an this gospel is in Luke's gospel and John's gospel certainly have promoted an unfair reputation for the Jews. It's easy to forget the original audience and context of the gospel writers. The first audience is an early Christian community who had tried to remain as part of the synagogue. After all, Jesus was a Jew. They were a follower of Jesus. And it's easy to forget that they were part of a Jewish community. And only when there started to be significant divisions did they leave and form their own worshiping community or get asked to leave the synagogue. Didn't work out for them to stay part of the Jewish community. I think a very brief history of Christianity would show you how easy it is. If you ask your parents or your grandparents, how did Catholics and Lutherans talk about each other? You understand why there are now countless Christian denominations. A disagreement leads to an argument, leads to people being ejected or leaving voluntarily their own Christian community. A lot of the talk between and about denominations is at least uncharitable and often untrue. So I want to be clear that Luke and John's gospel they have an agenda. And that agenda includes painting Judaism in an unfavorable light. I get it. I usually like to compare my heroes with your villains. I look better that way. So they paint the opposition in unflattering terms. And I bring this up because anti-Semitism has been promoted by the church. Prejudice has been rationalized from texts like this. And anti-Semitism is real and ugly and dangerous. And I don't want to let the text encourage it unnecessarily. So allow me to do a little editing of the text, and you've already heard it, so I'm going to read my version of it to you again. Jesus also told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, was praying thus, "God, I thank you that I am not like other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or traitors. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all my income. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even look up to heaven, but was beating his breast and saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his home justified. Okay, so I edited it pretty severely to leave out the parts that were just flat out accusatory of the Pharisees. Why would I do that? Because the fact is, the Pharisees in the original context were the good guys. Not only that, they're still the good guys, the Pharisee types, thus the title, Pharisee types, welcome, no questions asked. Ask any pastor, any church council member, and certainly any church treasurer, if they wouldn't mind having a couple of dozen people who tithed 10% of their income, showed up at worship every time there was an event. I don't know about the fasting twice a week, but the commitment to being faithful, absolutely. Churches would be very happy to have more Pharisee types. Not only can you depend on their generosity, you can depend on their honesty, too. So, I think I told you I have this imaginary cul-de-sac, my neighborhood from hell, where Stephen King lives on one side of me and Jack Nicholson lives on the other, and I can go through the list of other folks that in my nightmares live on my cul-de-sac. I also have a cul-de-sac from heaven, a dream neighborhood. And some of the people in that dream neighborhood are Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush, not because I happen to like all their policies. It's not about policy, it's about character. The Pharisees were people with character. I would want Pharisees on my dream cul-de-sac. Tax collectors, on the other hand, live in my nightmare neighborhood, almost universally hated by their fellow country people, because they worked for the occupying Romans. And they made a very handsome living by extorting everything they could out of their own people. And then paid a flat fee to the Romans. Whatever extra they could rip off, skim from their fellow citizens, they did. And notice, when this guy makes his confession in the parable, he's having a rare truthful moment, because his whole life was built on corruption. And just to be clear, it's a rare truthful moment, so take note of what he doesn't say. He says, be merciful to me, a sinner, and stops there. He does not add, and I promise to do better, because he had no intention of doing better. It's not a good idea to lie to God, especially when you're in church, right? I don't know about you, but pretty much every Sunday at the confession and forgiveness, there's that silence for self-reflection and examination. Reflection and self-examination. And pretty much during that silence, I don't have any trouble coming up with a list of things to confess. And the first ones come very quickly, because I've been confessing them pretty much my whole life. Procrastination, judgmentalism. I expect you have your own list. Whatever your favorite vices are, it's not hard to come up with them. The tax collector didn't have much trouble either. He lived them every day. They were repetitive. And he was not about to change them. We need to remember, in the light of this parable, that it was in the First Testament, the Hebrew Bible, that we get Psalm 130. If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, Lord, who could stand? So this is not a condemnation of Pharisees. And St. Paul, a Pharisee, if you will, wrote while we were yet sinners, God justified the ungodly. Let's not get this wrong. The point of the parable is not be humble, don't be proud. That's not bad advice. I hope we all would raise our kids and promoting that as a virtue, that is humility. Good idea. Although God doesn't need our humility, but our neighbors do. So it's a good thing to promote. But the parable isn't about that. Good advice, not so good theology. The parable isn't about our virtues and vices. It's about God. And frankly, God cheats. From Gerhard Frost, Blessed Be the Ordinary. I remember my mouthy days, my dazzling debates with Mom and Dad. Like a winner, I'd confidently argue. Condescendingly, I'd instruct. Tolerantly, I'd repeat. Patiently, I'd wait until, without a moment's warning, one of them would say, "You know, we love you." "Owl," I'd yearn to cry, and I'd want out. They'd struck so hard and below the belt. Love cheats. It always does. There is no defense. Thanks be to God.